Today on Reader's Corner, Tara Westover, author of the memoir, Educated. Hello and welcome to Reader's Corner. I'm Marcia Franklin with Idaho Public Television, sitting in for Bob Kustra. He's on a well-deserved vacation after retiring from 15 years as the president of Boise State University. Have no fear, though, he'll be back, and I know he's looking forward to devoting even more time and energy to Reader's Corner. In the meantime, I'm pleased to welcome today's guest, author and Idaho native, Tara Westover. Ms. Westover grew up in far southeastern Idaho in a landscape familiar to many in the Gem State, a valley dominated by ranches and ringed by mountains. Her daily life, though, was anything but normal. The youngest of seven children, Westover was raised by parents who deeply distrusted government and authority figures. She didn't have a birth certificate, she never attended public school, and she never visited a doctor or nurse. At age 17, though, Tara taught herself enough to pass the ACT and be accepted into Brigham Young University. She went on to earn a doctorate at Cambridge University in England and be awarded a fellowship at Harvard. The story of her remarkable journey and the personal traumas that haunted her along the way are the subject of her memoir, Educated. Right after its publication in February 2018, Educated shot up to the top of the New York Times bestsellers list. Praised by critics as harrowing and one of a kind, the book is being translated into 23 languages. Now, Ms. Westover, who still lives in Cambridge, England, will be coming to Boise in February 2019 as part of the Cabin's Readings and Conversation series. She joins me today by Skype from New York City. Tara Westover, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, first of all, congratulations. As I mentioned, your book hit the top of the New York Times bestseller list as soon as it was published, and even now, 4 months later as we're talking, it's still on that list. Can you describe...
No one's more surprised than I am.
I was going to say, can you describe what the past 4 months have been like for you?
No, I can't. I don't know if there are words. It's just been really busy. I mean, writing a book is... it's something that you just do, you know, you're alone and you sit in a room and there's nobody there and you write this thing and you don't know if anyone's ever going to read it. Even when you say you're going to publish it, it's a strange thing because you're not there when people read it. You know, you don't witness any of this. So there's this strange disconnect in my head where I still feel like this is something that I wrote alone in a room. And it's just really strange to think. But, you know, when people come up to me and talk about specific things in there, there's just this kind of reptilian part of my brain that is still thinking, how do you know about that? That's on my laptop. So
that's funny. Do you have an idea in your mind, or to what do you attribute the book's success? Do you think it's a prurient interest in how you grew up? Do you think it's...
I hope it's not that. Mm-hmm. I don't think so. I think that those kind of memoirs of extreme upbringings are kind of been there, done that, you know, just a little bit. So I hope it's not that. For me, the survivalism and my parents' extremism, you know, they didn't believe in education, so we didn't go to school. They certainly didn't believe in public education. They didn't believe in doctors and hospitals, so we never went to the doctor. I didn't even have a birth certificate till I was 9. All of this, it is extreme, but I think of that more as the setting of a story. That's just the setting. It's just the backdrop. And I think the story of the family, about education, about kind of difficult or maybe even toxic relationships and what happens when you try to ask for change within your family, these are things that I think people experience in all kinds of families. And I don't think you have to have a radical parent or a radical upbringing to experience these kinds of things. So I tend to think it has to do with the themes of education and what it means to become educated, and also just what it means to grow up. And I think that's universal for everybody. Part of what it means to grow up is just learning to define yourself, both in connection to and in kind of distinction from your parents.
Certainly, and we'll get into this more, but I read it as a story about the life of the mind as well, and the development of the life of the mind. Did you have an audience in mind when you wrote the book, though, or were you writing it mostly for yourself in a way?
I don't know if I had a particular audience in mind. It's a different kind of writing when you write a story for other people than when you write for yourself. because when you write for yourself, there's a lot of things that are just meaningful to you because it's your life. And if you're writing for other people, you have to impose a discipline on that because you have to not put things in unless you can create that kind of meaning for someone who doesn't know about it. So it's a very different kind of writing. But I think, yeah, I mean, you said it about the life of the mind. I think for me, the questions that the book asks are a lot about change and becoming, and, you know, whether your first self is your only true self or whether you're allowed to change, and what happens when the people close to you maybe can't allow you to change or just can't, for whatever reason, accept any other version of you. So I was raised in a family that had very specific and very extreme beliefs. And when I made the decision to try to educate myself when I was 16, I bought a textbook. I taught myself enough algebra to kind of scrape through the ACT and be admitted to Brigham Young University. You know, that put me on a path that was in a lot of ways in opposition to my parents. And so for me, that choice of education and change, it was always going to come with a lot of complicated questions about how to be loyal to my family and also try to be loyal to myself in some way. And what was I going to do if it turned out that it wasn't possible to be loyal to both?
Speaking of loyalty, you do have a statement in the beginning of your book that clearly indicates that this is not about Mormonism or any other religion for that matter, although you were in fact raised LDS. Why did you feel the need to put that qualifier, for want of a better word, in?
There were a couple of reasons. You know, my dad was Mormon. He was LDS, but he wasn't representative of the Mormon church or of your typical LDS person. You know, everyone in my town was LDS, and everybody went to school and they went to the doctor and they had birth certificates. So I don't feel like it's the religion that explains the way that we grew up. I've hypothesized that I think my dad had something like bipolar disorder. And to me, my feeling has long been that the bipolar disorder probably caused the religious extremism and not the other way around. So I just didn't want to add a story or create a story that would just increase people's prejudices or confirm stereotypes that people have of what a religious person is or what a conservative person is or what an Idaho person is. I felt like there's a way in which you could say my dad is a caricature of a survivalist, but he's also a really full and complete human being. And he loved his family and worked hard and worried about how he was going to keep the lights on and food on the table. And he's a lot more complicated than his kind of radical ideas. So I really wanted to move away from stereotypes as much as I could.
You mentioned you didn't have a birth certificate. You know, that was not uncommon in the beginning of the 20th century. People had their babies at home, for instance. Why was it that your parents, in this instance, didn't want to have a birth certificate for you and their other six children?
You know, I don't always know. My parents definitely had a skepticism of the government. They didn't like to fill out paperwork if they didn't have to do it. And so my dad, I think it started when my dad became he started to develop these kind of extreme ideas about medical profession. So he developed kind of theories about doctors and that they might be trying to harm you that later would become quite spiritual. And he would say that it was kind of sinful if you visited a doctor, that actually God wouldn't heal you if you visited a doctor because that was so sinful. So he began to develop these ideas that would make him not want my mother to have the children in a hospital, but wanted her to have her last four children at home, which she did. So I don't know if the reason that they didn't register us for birth certificates was because of the just reluctance to file paperwork, or if it was just kind of maybe a bit of casual laziness about, you know, once we were at home, it's a whole extra step to get a birth certificate. No one hands you the form. So I don't know exactly why they didn't, but it could have been either of those things.
Well, we don't have time to go into it, and there's some things that I think people should just read in the book, but it's a very interesting story about how you got one. Now, place and setting is extremely important to your book, and I think you're really exquisite in your descriptions of setting, but you don't name your hometown in Idaho. It's not too hard to figure out which town it is. So why did you go with that approach?
You know, I mean, this book is about estrangement. It's about people who have different memories of the past and just different ideas in general within a family. And I think any time that you're writing about people who are alive, you have to try to be sensitive about protecting their privacy as much as you can. And so I have never wanted to be the source of identifying my parents if I could avoid it. They've identified themselves in a lot of ways in in interviews they've given, but I don't want to be the one who does that.
You know, many people wait until they're older to write memoir, not only because their story arc is more developed in their life, but also because of a fear of hurting people that are still alive. So they wait for some of those people to pass away. Why did you decide to write this memoir so early in your life? And did you worry about criticizing people who are still alive?
I did. I absolutely did. And I think I had to really weigh why I wanted to write the book against the possibility of upsetting someone who I cared about. And that was a really difficult process, to be honest. I felt like it had to be written when I was younger. And the reason I felt that, you know, I went through this really difficult process of being disowned by my parents. And then eventually they offered me a path back into the family. If I kind of was willing to recant some of my beliefs and some of the things I'd said, then I could come back into the family. And I made the decision not to do that. I made the decision to remain estranged from my parents. And when I was going through this process, and it really is a process of estrangement, I think it takes months or even years, I felt really isolated. And I felt like I was the only person who had ever had this happen to them. And I know now that's not true. It actually happens to a lot of people. A lot of people struggle with relationships and how, where to put the line and how to maintain the line and try to maintain their own sanity despite difficult relationships in their lives. But at the time I was going through it, it seemed to me like I was completely alone. And there were some books that people had written about these kind of experiences. But as you said, they tended to be written when people were older, when they were towards the end of their lives. And I think those books are valuable, but they're very different. And they didn't necessarily, you know, estrangement feels different at the end of your life, 30, 40 years down the road. I think the way that you feel about it evolves over the decades. And I was 28 and my parents were in good health and I was in good health. And I knew I was going to be living with this decision for a really long time. And it wasn't settled. It was completely chaotic. And I didn't understand the feelings that I had. I didn't understand how it could be possible that I could love someone and still choose not to see them anymore, or that I could miss them every day and still be just so grateful that they weren't in my life. And I just felt like there was such a benefit that might be possible for other people in a situation like I was in, that I think I felt like there was just a gap there. I think stories are so important to us in telling us how to feel. You know, they tell us when we're supposed to be proud, when we're supposed to be ashamed. And I just felt like this was a story that it needed to be told from that point in time. And waiting would have made it a very different story.
I'm Marcia Franklin, sitting in this week for Bob Kustra on his show, Reader's Corner. I'm talking with Tara Westover about her memoir, Educated. It's amazing to me that you had both the presence of mind to walk towards this instead of away from it, and also the courage to do that. And you remind me of someone I know here in Idaho who did grow up in a very similar fashion to you. I wrote her to tell her I was doing this interview and asked her if she had any questions for you. And she said, you know, I have not been able to read her book yet. I feel as if it may create some PTSD or bring up PTSD feelings. What would you say to somebody like her who is still struggling? She's probably a couple years older, actually, than you are. What would you say to her?
I think people heal in their own way. You know, and I think for some people, probably putting difficult things away and not thinking about it, maybe that is the right call, and maybe that's the right choice for them. I think for people who find story helpful, I think it's because it's very difficult to work out how you feel, not just about other people, but about yourself. How do you feel about the decisions that you had to make? And, you know, I would say there were a lot of years I was really angry at my parents. And I think the reason I was so angry is because, not because I hadn't forgiven them, but because I hadn't forgiven myself. I was really angry at myself for having made the decision not to see them anymore. And because of that, I had to constantly bring up every terrible thing they'd ever done and constantly tally up to try to justify myself, to try to make it okay. And that was all about them and how terrible they were. And it took me a lot of years to work out that, you know, the best way forward for me, at least, was not to make it about them, but to make it about myself. and what I needed. So not that I couldn't see my father anymore, not because he deserved it, not because he's a terrible person, because he isn't and he doesn't, but because I simply needed that space. So it was more about valuing myself than about hating someone else. And that was a really peaceful way for me to move forward. And I hope that some people will read the story and they can judge me. That's why we have stories, is so that we can kind of identify with characters and decide what we think about the choices that they made, and hopefully work out just how they feel about their own decisions. Maybe by seeing how they feel about my decisions, they can work out how they feel about their own. But for people who don't want to do that or feel like the best thing to do is put it away, I mean, I'm in no position to tell someone how they should move forward in their lives. It's entirely their call.
You know, I really like how your book presented so many paradoxes or yin-yang situations. One is that while the landscape you lived in was so beautiful, it was also a place of hazard, and that included your father's scrapyard in which you and your other siblings worked. Talk about how your father made an income that way and what your work sometimes entailed.
So my dad ran a junkyard, a salvage yard, which basically meant for a lot of the time we would just sort salvage metal into, you know, we'd sort copper from aluminum, from steel in order to sell it. So it could be really dangerous work. It didn't have to be as dangerous as it was. You know, my dad, for whatever reason, just didn't seem to have that bone in his head that tells a lot of people this is dangerous. We should do it a different way, or we should slow down. And I think with the book, one of the hardest things for me has been trying to convince people that it wasn't malicious. You know, we didn't get injured all the time because my dad didn't care about us. I think it's not that he didn't care about our safety. He just wasn't able to keep us safe. He wasn't able to understand the risk. And for me, I think the most, the strongest bit of evidence for that is that the worst injury that happened in my father's scrapyard happened to my father. So he was removing a fuel tank from a car, and he made the decision that it was unnecessary to drain the fuel first from the car because it would take too long. And so he just lit a cutting torch and started cutting the tank off, even though it was half full of fuel. And of course, what happened is that the car exploded, and my dad was burned terribly. I mean, he nearly died. And of course, because my parents don't believe in doctors or in hospitals, they didn't take him to a hospital. They just treated it at home. They had no morphine. They had no IV. And yeah, he nearly died. And the recovery was months and months. And to me, it just kind of shows my dad, it's not as though he was very careful with his own safety and then very flippant with ours. It's not as though when we were injured, he would take himself to a hospital, but he wouldn't take us, and he denied us medical care. I mean, he really sincerely believed that the doctors were going to injure us. And as strange as it is to try to explain to someone, if that's your belief, then denying your children medical care, that's what love looks like. So it's one of those very complicated situations where a family situation can be difficult, can be a bit toxic, but without any malicious intent at all.
So it sounds like you don't, I think what's difficult for some people is the not taking to the doctor part of it. And your mother, you know, treated with herbs and tinctures and essential oils and still has a successful essential oils business. Some people would view not taking your own children to the doctor or the hospital for an injury or an illness as a form of abuse.
Yeah, and that's kind of, I mean, I don't disagree. Again, I don't think it comes from anything intentional. Their beliefs are so sincerely held. You know, when my brother lit his leg on fire and was covered in third-degree burns, or I got impaled by a spike through my knee, we never treated any of these things in the hospital. I mean, we never had tetanus shots, and we were working in a junkyard all the time. And it sounds to people like this is just a callous disregard for life. And it wasn't. They were sincere beliefs that my parents held. That doesn't mean that they're not abuse. And it took me quite a long time, I think, to be able to understand that complex fact that people can be abusive and not mean to. People can love you and still hurt you. And that's kind of what I was saying about making it about yourself and not about them, because I think people can be incredibly hurtful to other people without meaning. without meaning it. And for me, I think it took me a long time to walk away from those relationships. And one of the reasons was because they're good people and they love me and I love them and the love was real and their good qualities, you know, really were good. My dad really was a good person. My mother could be incredibly kind and self-sacrificing, and my dad as well. And for a long time for me, it was easy to take the good in them and use it to kind of justify the bad and continue subjecting myself to things that were really damaging to me. And I suppose that's why in the end I found it so much more peaceful to make it about myself and what I needed and what I felt like I deserved rather than what they were doing or whether I thought it was the right thing or especially whether I thought they meant to harm me, because they never did.
I'm not sure if you're aware, but there's, you know, more than half the states in the country, including Idaho, have what are called faith healing exemptions written into their child abuse and neglect laws. Basically, if a parent such as yours claims that their religious beliefs prevent them from taking their child to a medical professional, even if that child dies, they can use that as a defense. And there are some child welfare advocates and lawmakers in Idaho who have been trying to modify that law unsuccessfully. Do you have thoughts on that? Should those faith healing exemptions be written into the law?
I don't think that they should, personally, but I get why it's an incredibly thorny issue. I think it's a tendency in Idaho and in a lot of other states to prioritize the rights of parents over the rights of children. And I think we have to ask ourselves why we do that. With things like the foster care system, I have a brother who's been a foster parent several times now, and watching what the kids have to go through before they will terminate parental rights and just let them find a home, it's just very clear to me that we take the rights of parents and we put a much higher premium and a much higher value on the rights of adults than we do children.
Your book is called Educated, so let's talk about your education. You had nominal homeschooling. It really wasn't that much, was it?
There wasn't a lot of formal homeschooling. I was taught to read by an older brother. I think my mother worked quite hard at the homeschooling when my older brothers were younger. I was the youngest of seven, so by the time I came along, there wasn't a lot happening. You know, I never listened to a lecture from my mother. I never wrote an essay for my mother. I never took an exam. The first exam I ever took was the ACT, which I don't recommend for your first exam ever. So we had some books in the house, but we didn't have a lot of textbooks. We just didn't have. So when I wanted to learn algebra, I had to go buy a textbook because we didn't have it. And then the only person who could teach it to me was my mother, and she'd kind of forgotten most of it. So it was a challenging situation to try to get an education, because my mother was very busy. She was running a business. She was running a farm. She had a lot of kids. And then at a certain point, it was just kind of beyond her ability to teach.
Did you yearn to go to school? There's a scene where you talk about the school bus down below your house and seeing that.
I did sometimes, because I was a lonely kid. There were other kids in the town. They all went to school. I never went to any of their houses. They never went to mine. I had very little interaction with them. I wanted to be normal, I think, sometimes. But in general, no, because I believed that my family were living the right way. You know, my dad said that homeschool was God's plan, that it was a more righteous thing to do than going to school, which he said was kind of an abomination. I think he would have used that word. So I thought we were more righteous, and I thought we were living the right way, and this was just a price that you paid to be one of the Lord's chosen people.
You dedicate your book to one of your brothers, Tyler, who encouraged you to take the ACT and go to college, as he had. Several of your brothers did go on to college. How did you have the sense that you could even go and do this?
You know, my brother Tyler, I think it almost came entirely from him. I had a violent older brother, not Tyler, another brother who I call Sean in the book. And we had a very violent, difficult relationship. And my brother Tyler came home from college and witnessed a little bit of that. I don't think he knew the extent of it, but he witnessed a little bit of it and just became convinced that what I needed was to get out of there. And so he said to me, look, teach yourself enough algebra, teach yourself enough grammar to just scrape through the ACT. It's one test and then go to college. And so that's what I did. I didn't realize, I guess, at the time, if I did that successfully, then I would actually be in college. And being in college without having a formal education has its own set of problems, you know? So I just wasn't ready for college. You can trick your way into a university by telling them you're homeschooled, but if you weren't homeschooled, you know, you're going to get there and not know anything. So I'd never written an essay in my life. I thought Europe was a country, not a continent. I raised my hand in one of my first lectures and asked what the Holocaust was, because I'd never heard of it. I'd never heard of the civil rights movement. There were just, you know, that learning curve was really steep. And then socially, I just wasn't prepared. I'd never been around people my age. I'd never really been around a lot of people at all who weren't in my immediate family. So there was also just a pretty extreme social gap, which wasn't helped by the fact that I thought they were all kind of sinners and Gentiles because they went to the doctor and they'd gone to public school. And so I was at Brigham Young University looking around me thinking this den of sin, you know.
That's what I found that so interesting, that we think of that institution as conservative, but for you, it was uber liberal.
Wildly, wildly libertine. Yeah, the clothes people wore, just all the movies that they saw. I thought it was, and just literally that they went to the doctor, I thought was so sinful. And I thought the spirit can't be with them if they're going to the doctor. So in a lot of ways, I isolated myself pretty thoroughly.
This is Marcia Franklin with Idaho Public Television, and I'm talking with Tara Westover about her memoir, Educated. Reader's Corner host Bob Kustra returns next week. It is amazing to me that you persevered, though, and you pushed through that. And I was very touched by the scenes in the book of the professors who mentored you and really changed your life. Those professors, one of whom recommended you for the special study abroad program at Cambridge University, which, of course, changed the course of your life.
Yeah, I had some amazing people just do amazing things to try to help me. And it's another reason I wanted to put the note at the front of the book that this isn't a story about Mormonism, because again, I just think people are more complicated, and sometimes we reduce people to their simplest form. And I think it is just another form of prejudice when you take one fact about a person and just completely reduce them. So, you know, I had religious people in my life who were wonderful, and I had religious people in my life who were terrible, and I can't quite work out that it's the religion that made the difference. You know, I had a bishop at BYU, kind of the leader of a congregation, and he had some very traditional views. He thought that I should get married, and was very encouraging of me for that. You know, even though I was 17, he thought, this is the goal, this is the path for you. And that's a conservative kind of religious viewpoint for sure. But he was incredibly, you know, he valued me as a human being, and he wanted to help me achieve my, you know, whatever I wanted. And so when I was, I think it would have been my sophomore year, I developed a terrible toothache, you know, just unbelievably bad. And I didn't have any money to go get it fixed. I needed a root canal. And I went months and I couldn't fix it because I didn't have the money. And he wrote me a personal check from his personal account. I think it was for $1,400, which, I mean, who does that? Who says, oh, here's $1,400 that I'm going to give to this near stranger because I want her to stay in school, because I was going to drop out of school and get a job so that I could get this tooth fixed. And so, you know, I just think people are very complicated. And I think that it's so easy to just characterize people and say, oh, here's this conservative bishop. He was trying to just, you know, force her into this role of a wife and mother. And I think, yeah, he had those beliefs. Those were his beliefs. But he was incredibly generous and did more for me to make sure that I stayed and got my education than almost anyone.
Now, at the same time that the life of your mind was opening up, your physical life, your actual life, was bifurcated. You would go home in the summer to Idaho and back into a situation that is a running thread throughout your book, which is the abuse by another brother who you've given a pseudonym, a Sean. This was another one of these yin-yang situations. He was both your protector sometimes, but he was also definitely an abuser. And confronting this situation was what finally estranged you from, you know, a good half of your family. Was it hard to write about this, or was it cathartic? And I don't want to give a lot away. I think people should read the book and should understand the arc that you went through.
The things that were hard to write about the book weren't necessarily the things I thought would be hard. I thought that the violence would be hard to write about, and it wasn't. I think I'd kind of come to terms with it. It was much harder to write about the beautiful things from my life, you know, canning peaches with my mother or walking on the mountain gathering herbs with her. These were the things about my childhood I loved the most, and these were the things I had lost. And I, you know, that's why I say the extremism in my family was kind of the setting, because it was difficult to navigate my family's extremism, and we had very different views. And I went off to Cambridge, and they were living more and more radically, and their beliefs were getting more and more extreme. But we were kind of navigating that. We were finding ways to kind of be a family despite that. And what broke my family apart wasn't my father's radicalism or my going to Cambridge. What broke my family apart wasn't even my brother's violence. It was the response that my parents had when I confronted them about my brother's violence. And that was something that the family unit just couldn't survive. In a lot of ways, it wasn't the abuse that broke us. It was the cover up, I think.
I find the footnotes in your book intriguing. They acknowledge that your memory about certain events may be faulty, and they provide alternate stories from other family members. It almost feels as if this is the academic side of you coming in. You're overarching, you know, you have an interest in historiography and in who writes history. And I thought it actually was a really intriguing thing to do, an honest thing to do.
Well, I ended up getting my PhD in history from Cambridge. And I think it's just the historian in me. I did a lot of interviews with family to try to work out the timeline, try to work out what happened, try to make sure that I wasn't the only one who remembered a certain thing a certain way. And there were some cases, a couple of just big, big important events that initially the people I had talked to had all corroborated my version. And then as I was writing the book, other versions came out. And I thought, right, I'll try to write it in such a way that everyone's version is represented. And in some cases, it just wasn't possible. Someone was wrong because there wasn't a way that everyone could be right. And, you know, I guess it was just the historian in me that at a certain point just said, you know what that is? That is a footnote. And you just say to people, there are differences here. There are distinctions between the ways that people have constructed certain memories. And I wanted to take it a bit further. And I include a note on the footnotes at the end of the book about the reasons that certain stories are perpetuated, I think. You know, there are reasons why I remembered it one way that had to do with how I saw my father and how I saw the rules of my family. And there are reasons that other of my siblings remembered it differently, that were based on the ways that they perceived my father and the rules of our family. And some of that had to do with gender, and some of that probably had to do with age. Some of my siblings are a lot older than I am. They almost had different parents. So, you know, my oldest brother was allowed to go to school, which is just unthinkable for me. I can't even imagine my father letting me go to school, but he's 12 years older than I am. So, you know, he just had a different father who wasn't quite as radical by that point. To me, it just seemed the most reasonable thing is to say, you know, this is a book that is a lot about memories. It's a lot about who gets to tell their own story, who gets to tell stories about the past. At the heart of this book is me saying my older brother is violent and my parents saying that he isn't. And that's what they say today, and that's what I say today. So it didn't seem possible to write a story without acknowledging that there are different points of view and different memories that people have.
For someone who had never written in this style before, I found your writing, you know, extraordinary. The words that you chose, your metaphors are evocative. And as I read the book, I really could see it as a movie, as a film. Do you think that that's part of its future?
I don't know. Film makes me very nervous because I think you have no control over it and you have no idea what people will do with it. So I have no idea. Basically, it's hard for me to imagine a film, but people do say that. I think I did write it in a filmic way, but I just have no idea what will happen in terms of a film.
Well, I'm a big believer as well, and some things just need to be kept as a book. So, you know, we're emanating from a university, this program, and I would like, as we start wrapping up here, for you to talk a little bit about education and your views on it. It changed your life. That's the title of the book, Educated. Many people now are not sending their children to university, or certainly not to four-year institutions. There's a concern that not only is it so expensive, but also that it should really be preparing an individual for a job. not, you know, a general liberal arts degree. What is your sense about that?
My worry is kind of the opposite, in the sense that I worry that increasingly even universities are becoming job training. I think that education, you know, we used to have things in our education system that were for the individual to just live a better, fuller, richer life. And those are the arts programs. Those are the literature programs and the music programs and the theater programs. And increasingly, I think in high schools and even in universities, that makes up less and less of the education. And what we're allowing education to become is job training. And we're dropping all the things that are of benefit to the individual, and we're increasing all the things that are of benefit to the employers. I really think that that is, you know, it's kind of a violation of Kant's imperative, like not to treat people as a means to an end, but they should be treated as an end in themselves. And I dislike the idea quite a bit of an education system that is, again, just replete with courses that are to benefit companies and employers and make people into better workers, but doesn't also have those things that are purely to benefit the individual and help them live a better life.
Tara, do you still consider yourself an Idahoan?
Yeah, I don't think you can ever really get rid of that. I'm glad that you can't. I always feel when I am, you know, flying into the Mountain West, there's just a kind of relief that you feel. If you grow up around mountains, the moment that you're back around mountains, there's just a kind of, just a relief or a peacefulness that you feel. And you didn't even know you were anxious until you're back.
Well, I so look forward to seeing what you continue to do. I hope you continue to write. I know you're not quite sure what's next, and you may be doing some journalism writing, but I really look forward to reading more of your writing. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us at Reader's Corner.
Well, my pleasure, and thank you for having me.
For our listeners, you'll have another chance to hear from Tara Westover when she speaks at the Cabins Readings and Conversations series in February 2019. For more information, check out the Cabins website at thecabin.org. Next week, David Goldfield, author of The Gifted Generation, When Government Was Good. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. I'm Marcia Franklin, sitting in for Bob Kustra, who returns next week. Please join him as he talks to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.